Hello and welcome to this special science podcast from the 2011 AAAS Annual Meeting in Washington, D.C. It's February 19th. I'm Robert Frederick. In this short podcast, we'll hear about the scientific and ethical issues in using surgery to treat psychiatric disorders. Science's Sarah Reardon spoke with Helen Mayberg of Emory University School of Medicine.
Dr. Mayberg, you work on deep brain stimulation in major depression patients. Can you tell us a little bit about what that technique is?
Well, deep brain stimulation is a technology that was initially developed in the contemporary era for movement disorder, namely tremor and Parkinson's disease. And it's a device that's implanted into the brain that allows for the focal directed stimulation of a very small brain region, be it a nucleus, a white matter tract, or the cortex itself. So it's a general technology that allows for controlled neuromodulation of the intended circuit.
And is this intended for every depressive patient?
Well, no. This is for patients who have not only failed multiple drugs and therapy, but who have failed electroconvulsive therapy, our best treatment, and who basically continue to be profoundly ill, intractable, if you will, in their major depressive episode and without alternatives. So that was the targeted group of patients that we first began to investigate in 2002.
What kinds of successes are you having so far?
In my laboratory, and this started from work when I was at University of Toronto, involved first a group of six intractably depressed patients. And that first group of patients that we published on in 2005, four of the six patients met our 50% drop in depression severity scores at 6 months, but actually met the criteria for near remission. We expanded and implanted another 14, so we had a total group of 20, and actually found that at 6 months, the entire group, the original six combined with the second group of 14, we had a comparable 60% response rate that was maintained pretty much out to a year. And we published that result in 2008. My new group at Emory, we wanted to extend this work and to study additional patients and also explore issues of not just major depressive disorder, unipolar depression, but also to see whether there were any different safety or response characteristics in patients with bipolar disorder, as well as test questions about placebo response, as well as test questions about discontinuation. We have ongoing experiments to test that, and those studies are ongoing. So overall, we've been encouraged by these very initial, open-label, non-randomized studies in highly, highly selected patients, but that we're getting a fairly consistent pattern of somewhere between 50-60% response. We're learning about the recovery rate. We're learning about the characteristics of how the patients do and what elements of their illness are changing other than, you know, in some ways rather than others, and it's a work in progress. That said, it has also moved independent of our ongoing research studies. There's independently formal FDA-approved clinical trials to work toward testing this target in major depressed patients, intractable, as I've described, done by industry. So there are parallel experiments.
This has been kind of a controversial area in the past, being able to do these brain surgeries. What kind of ethical considerations are there in deep brain stimulation, and are those any different than would be considerations in a drug to treat depression?
Well, I think, you know, anytime a patient has a medical or a psychiatric or a neurological condition, and the treatment being tested is still at the experimental stage, it's quite important that when a patient is suffering, however that's defined, that there's clarity and that there isn't therapeutic misconception that the treatment is being tested to see if it's safe and to see if it works. The only thing, and you know, arguments have been made, are intractably depressed patients somehow special, somehow more vulnerable, more desperate? Maybe they would take on surgery where a regular depressed patient wouldn't. So this becomes an issue about safety and benefit or potential benefit risk evaluation. These people are not incompetent. They are depressed. They're not demented, they're depressed, another way to say it. They are very much aware of their disability. Patients are very astute. I'll never forget patient 4 in Toronto. We did the first side. She had this fantastic effect on the table. And she knew it, we knew it. And I said, so you're feeling a little less nervous now? She says, you just finished the first side. I could still have a hemorrhage or a stroke. Finish the other side and we can talk about it. So this notion that they have unrealistic expectations or will take on things that are more dangerous because of their desperation, I don't think that's true. They are in a purgatory, a sustained purgatory, that they feel they might be better off dead, but they're not. And so they just want to be sure they're not worse than they are now. They hope to be better. So the thing that's special about doing surgery experimentally, it's not the surgery itself. Well, it is the surgery itself, that you have to weigh the benefit-risk ratio, which really enters into the equation, have you exhausted other options? And I think that's the most fundamental part. The issue with brain stimulation, unlike a drug that makes it unique, once you implant, it's in. You know, if you have a drug trial at the end of 6 months, a year, you can run it as long as you want. But when you decide to say, I don't think it works, you stop dispensing pills and you're done. This, when it doesn't work, you have to arrange for another surgery to take it out. Maybe it actually works some, so is a partial effect good enough? You know, the patient now owns the device, and we have an obligation to the patient as well to maintain that device. That goes for if it's working. Making a decision of what you'll do if a patient wants to take it out is another issue. I mean, there's risks of explantation, slightly less than risks of implantation. So there are elements when you are implanting a device in the brain. It's a long-term commitment. You become a collaborator with the patient in a way that I think you never are totally, even in a very tight therapeutic alliance with the patient. This is a long-term commitment of both the doctor and the team to the patient, but the patient to the team.
So who makes up this team? You don't just put in the device and then leave the patient.
The implant is quite easy. It's if something isn't working, who can make the nuanced assessment of, is it our fault? Is it the device's fault? Is it the parameter's fault? It's this constant iteration. Or is it that now the patient is back in the world? And the world can be a very cruel place. And that their brain is working fine, the device is working fine, and life isn't working so fine. And that has become the more existential question of this research. I actually think as a neurologist, that's the hard part. That, you know, I've always had this sense as a neurologist that if the science moves forward, we'll articulate the circuits, we'll be able to have a very evidence-based approach to these problems, we'll fix it. Well, we become reactive to our own illness, and it isn't just in psychiatric disease. It's in epilepsy, it's in Parkinson's, it's in Alzheimer's. We have changes in dynamics of families. What happens if someone's been incapacitated and suddenly isn't incapacitated anymore? You'd think everybody would celebrate. You can see that a spouse that has had to take care of someone they didn't like leaves. You can see a patient who's been dependent on a spouse they didn't like leaves. You have this interaction that is totally unpredictable from the very linear way that neurologists think. So the psychiatrists laugh at me, but it's been sobering to realize if we're correct scientifically, that we're changing the brain and allowing the brain to go about its business and unstick it, if you will, from the depression, that's just the beginning. In the way that if you're a runner and you've had a broken hip and have been disabled and stopped running over 3 years and you've gone from not running to not walking to using a cane to being in a wheelchair, and suddenly someone gives you a new hip, the presumption that I'm done when I know that I stuck your new hip in right is naive and is not fulfilling our obligation to the patient. It's not tested until you actually evaluate how is the functionality with rehabilitation. And we are now just realizing in all aspects of this field, neurology and psychiatry, and in the treatment of chronic illness more generally, that the rehabilitation part of the team is as fundamental and critical to the overall success as is the competence and precision of the surgeon, the competence and skill of the device tuner, the cheerleading of psychiatrists, but the rehab part and the patient's recognition of they are not a bystander. They actually do the heavy lifting once we take the parking brake off and they can drive the car. All I do is release the parking brake. Maybe we put some gas in the tank, but we don't get you to your destination. And the thing is, what your destination is somewhere very different than it was before you got sick. And framing what you want from your life when it's been in some form returned to you is actually the hard part.
All right. Thank you very much.
That was Science's Sarah Reardon speaking with Helen Mayberg of Emory University School of Medicine about the scientific and ethical issues in using deep brain stimulation to treat major depressive disorders. This has been a Special Science podcast from the 2011 AAAS Annual Meeting in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to Gretchen Kuda for her work on this show. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.